I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Since COVID-19 became a significant worry in Vermont and schools and childcare centers shut down, the majority of workers were told to work from home, and hospitals and medical centers closed their doors to non-essential medical procedures. Health officials say they've seen fewer people going in for even essential medical procedures. That's a significant worry. On Monday, Health Commissioner Dr. Mark Levine reiterated that people who think they're having a heart attack or other urgent medical concern should definitely go to a hospital, and that hospitals are working to make things safe for patients. But it's not just urgent medical care that public health officials are worried about. As more and more non-urgent medical procedures are coming back online, today we're going to talk through how it's going, what the concerns are, and what you should be considering going to the doctor for. The first thing we want to address is actually something that was brought to us as a concern, a potential drop in the childhood vaccination rate in Vermont. Dr. Rebecca Bell is a pediatric critical care doctor at the UVM Children's Hospital Pediatric Intensive Care Unit and president of the Vermont chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And she joins us now. Welcome back, Dr. Bell.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the concern about the childhood vaccination rate in the state of Vermont?
Well, we're all living now during a time where it's become really apparent what can happen when there's an infectious pathogen out there that we don't have community immunity to. So that's the SARS-CoV-2 virus right now that's causing COVID-19. And we really don't want to add another infectious pathogen to that list. And so we worry about kids not staying up to date on their immunizations. So it's not just the virus that causes COVID-19 out there. All these other viruses and bacteria are still present. They're still around. And we have really safe and effective immunizations that can protect our children from getting those things. And we want to make sure that our children stay protected and our community stays protected. And I am hopeful that now that we've had all this lived experience together of what physical distancing and quarantine and isolation means when you have this infectious pathogen, that people will really realize how important it is to stay immunized, to keep our community immunity levels up, and to heed the concerns of public health officials when they get worried about dropping levels of vaccination coverage. So, when the pandemic first started and the stay-at-home orders came into place in Vermont, it made sense that we really tried to limit who was potentially coming into the office. But now that we've sort of seen what the trajectory is in Vermont, we really think that routine healthcare, including well child visits and immunizations, are really vitally important. And they really are essential to keep our community healthy. And so we are now having families come in for their well child checks and continue to get their immunizations on time. So yes, we had that drop in immunization here in Vermont and across the country in the last 2 months. We're hoping to get everyone caught up. And so you might be getting calls from your pediatrician's office telling you to bring your kids in for immunizations. And that's why we just really need to stay on top of keeping our communities healthy.
You know, it's interesting. I want to tease out one thing that you said, Dr. Bell, because it's sort of a twofold issue. There's the like this problem, but on the other hand, this. So one of the issues is that, people may not be taking their children in for immunizations, or there may be sort of a delayed immunization procedure right now. And that's a concern. On the other hand, you think that people and parents and families may actually have a greater respect or a deeper understanding of the value of vaccines because of what we're going through. And so do you expect at some point perhaps to even see an increase in the vaccination rate? Vermont's vaccination rate is very high, but there are pockets where there are low vaccination rates, and depending on the age of the child or which vaccine we're talking about. But do you think we may actually see an uptick?
I hope so. You know, it's hard to know for sure, but you think about the general person right now who may be nervous about going to the grocery store or going out in public and realizing, wow, this might be how someone who is immunocompromised feels all the time when they're in an area where maybe the measles coverage isn't great. And so I do think there's going to be more empathy and more understanding for our community and community immunity. I mean, look at all that we are doing to help protect our community. We're doing, you know, making these huge sacrifices, and how desperate we all are for an effective COVID-19 vaccine. And remembering that, you know, we have vaccines to prevent all these other horrible infectious diseases. And I do hope that there'll be a greater understanding and appreciation for that.
Dr. Bell, were some vaccinations considered essential even during the sort of shutdown of non-essential procedures, like for infants and others? Were any of these pediatric vaccinations considered essential and young patients were still going in and getting them?
Yes, that's right. So for most practices for children under 2 years of age, they were still coming in and getting all of their vaccines. Some practices were meeting families out in the parking lot and giving the vaccines, in the car, because, you know, these children don't have immunity at all to some of these really serious infectious pathogens. So the practices really prioritize those young kids. And so really, when we look at the data, the health department data, what we see is a drop in vaccination rates among school-age children and adolescents, which we sort of expected because a lot of practices put that on hold for now. But what we want to do is get the message out there that, you know, it's time now to get our kids, you know, back up to date.
If everybody was staying home, or almost everybody, and certainly for kids, I mean, at least for my kids, they didn't enter another building other than their own home for more than 9 weeks, and just have entered like one since then. Wouldn't it be fairly safe to assume for many families that they could delay those vaccines because their kids were not going to be susceptible to anything if everybody was staying home? Or were there actual problems for those individual children if they didn't get their vaccines on schedule?
That's a great question. I mean, we certainly saw a drop in a lot of infectious illnesses because, you know, schools were closed and daycares were closed. I think what happened over the last 2 months was a safe and appropriate approach, which was to get the infants in, get them vaccinated, because when infants get these, especially some of these bacterial infections, they can get very ill. And prioritize it that way, knowing that the school-age children have some immunity to a lot of these pathogens. So I think it was appropriate at that time. What we just want to make sure is that going forward, especially now as we're starting to talk about reopening daycares and schools, that we now get kids back up to date.
Yeah, it's been kind of remarkable as a parent of small children. You see a lot of other types of coronaviruses come through in any normal spring. So, you know, you're seeing a lot of colds, a lot of runny noses in the young population. And it seems like many of us are experiencing more wellness on that score than we've had in any other cold and flu season leading up to this year when we've all been home.
Yeah. And so I work in the pediatric intensive care unit at UVM Children's Hospital, and we saw a huge drop in rates of serious influenza infection and respiratory syncytial virus, which is a common, sometimes very serious virus in young children. But on the other hand, there are still going to be things that happen no matter what. And so we are getting, you know, new cases, new diagnoses of childhood diabetes and childhood leukemia and injuries that are happening around the home. And those kids need, you know, care. And I think one thing that can be reassuring for some families about, you know, starting to come back to the offices and get their regular routine childcare, healthcare, is that we've been taking care of those kids for the last 2 months. And so while most of us have been staying home with our kids, there are some kids that need really consistent and frequent care, and they tend to be our most vulnerable. So our kids with cancer on chemotherapy, who are immunosuppressed, our kids with chronic respiratory illness, our kids that we really worry about potentially getting really sick from COVID-19. But those are the kids that have been going into their pediatrician's offices frequently because they've had to, and coming into the specialty clinic at UVM and coming into the hospital and getting admitted. And they've gotten the care that they've needed. And we've been able to do it in a safe way and provide the care safely so that we haven't transmitted, you know, COVID-19 to any kids. And so if we're able to really safely care for our most vulnerable children, we can also see, you know, all the kids in the community and make sure that we're following their growth and development, that they're getting the vaccines that they need, and that we're doing regular physical exams on them so we can pick up on any potential problems early.
When we heard Dr. Levine and other healthcare officials say that they've seen a drop in the number of adult patients who are coming in for urgent care and, you know, like a heart attack, and Dr. Levine said, I don't think the number of heart attacks is going down. I think the number of people going in with a concern about their medical condition is going down, and that's a worry. Are you seeing that in the pediatric community as well, that perhaps parents are wary of sending kids in for urgent concerns, or are you worried that kids are not getting critical care?
Yeah, I haven't seen many cases myself. I think parents have been very diligent about, you know, when their kid looks really sick or gets injured, that they bring them to care right away. But we do worry about some of the things that maybe are a little bit less urgent, that we're going to start to see more of those cases where we think, oh, wow, you know, if this child had been brought in, you know, a month ago, maybe we would have been able to pick up on this a little bit earlier. So we're not seeing it to the same degree as, you know, my colleagues in adult medicine are, but we are still, you know, worried and concerned about it.
What concerns do you have about pediatric mental health? We continue to hear that mental health is a big concern moving forward, somewhat due to isolation, but lots of other stress factors. And, you know, the pediatric population also may struggle with mental health issues related to what they've been experiencing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of our big worries. And, you know, our pediatricians have done a great job of reaching out to their patients, especially patients that, you know, are at risk for mental health issues, and checking in with them via telehealth or in person if needed. And so, you know, we reach out to the families that we, you know, are particularly worried about. But, you know, one of our great partners in keeping kids healthy are our educators. And our kids aren't, you know, they may not be seeing our educators. Well, they're not seeing our educators in person and may not be checking in with them as much, you know, in other ways. And so, you know, that's something we worry about with mental health. It's something we worry about with child abuse, is that our, you know, the rates of child abuse reports have decreased, but it probably doesn't mean there's less child abuse going on. It just means that there are fewer people in contact with the child. So we are definitely thinking about the long-term effects. I think the biggest effect from COVID-19 are going to be the secondary effects on kids. It's going to be effects of isolation, effects of, you know, poverty with higher unemployment rates, their disruption in education. So we're all acutely aware of that and concerned, and want to keep in close contact with our families.
Before we let you go, I know we're talking mostly about non-COVID medical care today, but could you just address concerns and questions about what is emerging as a significant but small number of children who experience pediatric inflammatory multisystem syndrome alongside COVID-19?
Yeah, sure. So this is now being called multisystem inflammatory syndrome, MIS, of children and adolescents temporarily associated with COVID-19. So what we're hearing are descriptions of clusters of kids, mostly school-age kids and adolescents, in areas where there's a high prevalence of COVID-19, who are presenting with sort of system-wide, body-wide organ damage, high levels of inflammation in their body, and sometimes shock. And so these are symptoms that we see sometimes related to other common viruses. And we, you know, at the Children's Hospital take care of kids like this pre-COVID-19 who've had these symptoms for other reasons. But what our colleagues in New York and in London and some other places are telling us is we're really seeing a lot of the more cases than we normally would. It's still rare, but we're seeing it more than we normally would. And they tend to have antibodies to COVID-19. So not actively infected with COVID-19, but they check antibodies and those tend to be positive. And so the concern from the pediatric community is that this could be a reaction to a recent infection from COVID-19. So I think there are three things for families to know. One is that it is still very, very rare. Number two, although this is a new entity, we do treat kids with these types of symptoms all the time. And so when you read about kids potentially needing intensive care, potentially needing care from a wide range of pediatric subspecialists, we have that capability at UVM Children's Hospital. We do treat kids with heart failure and shock and hyperinflammatory issues all the time. So we're able to treat the symptoms, but we're still learning more about this particular entity and how can we optimize our management. We have not seen any of these cases, COVID-19 related cases in Vermont, but we do treat kids with this for other reasons. There's no real easy test to diagnose this, and there's no easy treatment that could prevent this. So what parents should do is really just do what you would normally do, which is if your kid is acting sick, if they've had fevers for a few days, if they're not drinking, and if you're just worried, just give your pediatrician a call and they'll want to see your child just like they normally would. So it doesn't change a lot, which is kind of hard because there's a lot of headlines. There's not much to do differently except for continue to just, you know, be aware that this is an entity, and it's really more about how your child looks and how sick they look, as opposed to, you know, their sort of list of symptoms. But it does continue to be a rare entity, but one we're acutely aware of.
That's Rebecca Bell, pediatric critical care doctor at the UVM Children's Hospital in the Pediatric Intensive Care Unit. She's also president of the Vermont chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Bell, thank you very much for updating us and talking with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Dr. Stephen Leffler is president and chief operating officer at the UVM Medical Center. Jody Stack is chief nursing officer and vice president of patient care services at Brattleboro Memorial Hospital. And they join us now to talk about some of the overviews of what hospitals and medical offices are trying to grapple with as we return to some non-urgent procedures. Jody Stack, Dr. Stephen Leffler, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us, Jane.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit first about what is coming back. And I think maybe a definition would be helpful because this question of elective procedures came up early in the shutdown. So almost 2 months ago now, when patients were trying to figure out, you know, is my procedure that was scheduled for April or May going to be canceled? I don't think of it as elective. Things like spinal fusion surgery we were hearing about, some cancer surgeries. These are not necessarily elective, but maybe non-urgent. So, Jody Stack, can you talk about that definition of non-urgent or elective procedures?
Sure. And we, at BMH, we have a strong surgical governance council that is led by our chief of surgery and comprised of surgeons in each specialty, proceduralists, anesthesia, and some administration. So there was a process and a forum to have these discussions. Certainly emergent surgery, so anything coming into our emergency department and needing to go to the OR right away, that criteria stayed the same. For urgent cases, something we defined as something that would cause harm if delayed for a prolonged period. So all of our elective scheduled cases were canceled if they could be delayed for a few weeks or a month. But each surgeon reviewed their individual panels, reached out to all of their patients, and took each case by case. If they felt like delaying the surgery for a couple weeks was going to cause harm in any way, they brought to a smaller subset of that council, which consisted of our chief medical officer, chief of anesthesia, and the chief of surgery, and talked about why this case should be brought in. That group approved, and we brought those people in. So there was a sort of a vetting process to make sure that we were safely able to do the surgeries that had to be done.
Is that pretty much how it went at UVM Medical Center as well, Dr. Leffler?
Almost identical. So we had the same process. We asked our surgeons to prioritize their list, and there were people that could safely be deferred for some period of time, a couple weeks or a month. And then over that time, we kept asking our surgeons to keep continually looking at their list, and some cases became necessary to do even during the time when we weren't doing elective surgery, but because they were necessary surgery, we went ahead and safely performed those cases.
Could you give me an example of that?
Cases that have been needed to be delayed a little longer.
Yeah, could you give me an example of something that might have fallen under what you thought you didn't necessarily have to do? You know, it wasn't somebody coming in having had a car accident and they needed emergency surgery, but the kind of thing, Dr. Loeffler, that you thought, okay, well, this actually is going to be a problem if someone waits a couple weeks.
So there's all kinds of examples. A good example might be someone who needs heart surgery. Some heart surgery is urgent and has to be done today or this week, and some can very safely be managed on medicine for some period of time and then needs to get done in, I would say, over 4 to 6 weeks. And so we had our surgeons continually looking at those lists. Some aneurysm surgeries are like that. Even some screening surgeries for some cancers can wait short periods of time very safely.
So let's talk about what is slowly being phased back in, what's allowed now, and what your hospitals are actually doing, because those may not be necessarily the same thing, what's actually allowed and what's being done. Jody Stack, what is happening now at Brattleboro Memorial Hospital in terms of procedures that you are moving forward with?
So starting this past Monday on the 18th, and again, we went through the same process with our Surgical Governance Council, how schedules would be built, how we would safely bring back patients. And so, of course, doing all of the things that are required, we're screening. We actually decided to test all of our patients that are having procedures, so we have that in place.
And do you do that with a rapid test, or is that something that you do a couple days in advance of the procedure?
We do it a couple days in advance, and then the patient quarantines.
Mm.
We get results back before they go in, and they have their procedure. So the types of procedures that we're doing are a lot of colonoscopies, screening colonoscopies that were delayed, so catching up on some of those. We have orthopedic procedures. We have some general and neurological procedures. I think the highest volume right now is probably those orthopedic procedures and endoscopy.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned colonoscopy because we got a question from Paul in Warren who says, when will it be safe to have a colonoscopy and under what circumstances and guidelines can this happen? So, Jody, it sounds like you are doing colonoscopies already.
Yep.
And are there specific guidelines that somebody like Paul would want to know about?
So just that it is safe to come in and do this. So we have put all of the things, like I said, that patients are being screened, that they're being tested. We're doing things in our waiting room to separate patients, so to make sure we have appropriate social distancing in clinical areas in the waiting rooms. So there is a process in place, and we feel confident that it is safe to come in and have those procedures, and we're continuing to monitor.
So, Dr. Loeffler, I mentioned that there are certain things that are allowed. As far as I understand, what is still not allowed are inpatient, non-urgent procedures. So if you had to come in for a surgical procedure or otherwise that was going to require you to spend the night or multiple days in the hospital, that is still not allowed, correct?
That's right, Jane. So starting on the 13th at the medical center, we started doing outpatient elective procedures, including colonoscopies, hand surgery, orthopedic surgery. We're ramping up to start doing eye surgeries. But to this point, the state has still not allowed us to start using inpatient beds to keep people overnight for elective care. So there are certain elective procedures that at this point we're still not doing for someone who would require overnight admission.
And do you agree with that?
I think it's very smart that the state is taking a careful approach on this. The reason to do that is because it preserves our beds right now. It helps manage our PPE supplies for people. And so I think a measured approach has served Vermont extremely well in this crisis. And I think gradually stepping back into these things is good. And we're also changing a lot of our processes around how we get people in and out of the hospital, visitors, masks for all of our patients. And so I think it is a good plan.
Dr. Loeffler, before we get to some of that, you mentioned that you're ramping up to do eye surgeries. So it sounds like that is allowed, but you haven't been doing it yet. Why not? What went into that decision?
Just getting people scheduled, getting their pre-ops done, getting their tests done for COVID-19. And so we have, two facilities we do surgery. We do cases at the medical center and also at our Fannie Allen campus. And getting the equipment, the surgeons, and the patients all in the same location takes some logistics.
Jody Stack, we were talking earlier with Dr. Rebecca Bell about the concern about whether or not patients were going in to get the critical care that they might need if they're wary of going into the hospital, or if they just say, I think I can handle this at home. I don't want to burden my healthcare system. How are you trying to walk that balance with patients of, you need to get the care you need, but there are other things that you might be able to wait on? How are you communicating that?
Right. we've been communicating that all along, and I think been, you know, very open with our community. We post community updates in a variety of forums to notify people of the changes, what the visitor policies are, you know, when they should come in, how they're coming in. So I think it's important for people to know the amount of effort that we put into maintaining this safe environment, that we do have procedures in place, that it is safe for them to come in. So I think the constant communication with the community is important, letting them know, you know, where we are and how we're keeping them safe. So you can tell just when you pull up that even as you walk into the hospital, there's signs very clearly marked. We have people wait in line 6 feet apart. They get, you know, greeted by a screener that asks them all the appropriate questions. We have people, visitors and patients coming in wearing masks. All of our staff are wearing masks. So really creating that safe environment so they feel safe coming to us.
And do you think they're getting that message? I mean, do you hear back from patients about whether that seems comforting to them or reassuring, at least, maybe not comforting, but, you know, whether that message is resonating in the right way?
I do think it is, and we do get feedback in a variety of ways for patients who come here. I think even though we're telling them everything that they're doing, that when they get here, they're very reassured. So we've gotten a lot of positive feedback about the care that is being taken, how well-spoken our staff are, about, you know, prevention measures and policies. So it's been very, very positive, and we've gotten positive feedback that people feel safe when they're here.
Dr. Loeffler, other than getting maybe a test in advance, which is what happens at Brattleboro Memorial Hospital, what other kinds of procedures do patients need to be aware of in terms of things that might be different about, you know, mask wearing or sanitation or other things that they can expect if they go to the hospital or a medical center?
So at the medical center, we're following a lot of similar procedures to Brattleboro. The big differences are patients are getting screened. Every patient, every staff member is getting screened when they come to the hospital. They're getting their temperature measured. They're getting asked about symptoms. Everyone's wearing a mask. We are doing social distancing. So for people that are having in-person appointments at the doctor's office, we're not letting people use the waiting room or calling them from outside to bring them in. So we're working hard to socially distance. And this is all because we're 100% committed to keeping our patients and our staff as safe as possible. And we have, I want to say that during the pandemic, we've done hundreds and hundreds of surgeries for people who needed emergent care. And we have no cases where patients have caught COVID while in the hospital receiving care at the UVM Medical Center.
Dr. Loeffler, do you have like the F-35s flying above you or something right now?
I do. I'm sorry.
I thought that might be what it is. Good to know. You know, there are questions still about what kinds of visitor policies are in place. I mentioned for people who are going in to give birth, that's been a particular concern for some families, you know, especially for the person who's giving birth who said, you know, I really thought I was going to have a support network here, maybe a partner, maybe somebody like a doula in addition to the medical staff who are already in the hospital. Jody Stack, what's happening at Brattleboro in terms of visitor procedures generally, but specifically let's talk first about birthing?
So we, since the beginning, we did restrict our visitor policy, you know, since the very beginning, but we have allowed one support person for women who come in labor and postpartum.
And what about more general visitor policies?
So more general, we restricted visitors. The exceptions are for a support person, for somebody who is laboring or postpartum, and one visitor for somebody who is the person's support person at home. So somebody who is already that person. And we also, for end of life, have allowed visitors, certainly pediatric patients who come in an emergency situation, we've allowed parents to come in.
When you say somebody who is a support person for that person generally, you mean like somebody who actually needs somebody for...
Yes, because of a disability.
Right, yeah. Right. So not necessarily, you know, a spouse or a partner who sort of just wants to accompany a patient. It's more if you need critical support.
Yes. And, you know, the community has been amazing. They've been understanding of the policy. I feel like we, you know, chose the right criteria. Our birthing center has worked very hard to be able to do that in a safe way and you know, create the right environment, because it was very important to have that support person. But people who have not been able to visit him have been told so, have received that very well. They understand why.
Dr. Leffler, that sounds similar to what UVM has put in place. Do you have any sense of when those restrictions might loosen up?
Our policies are very similar, and I want to say that we're thankful to our patients and families. They have been understanding of this. They understand the importance, and but it's tough. It's hard on people. We have made the decision that for now we're going to continue these policies at least through June 15th to go along with the governor's orders around when he's keeping social distancing restrictions up. We are making compassionate exceptions for certain cases, but to the extent possible, limiting visitors is one of the key things to socially distancing to keep our patients and our staff safe and so they don't catch COVID-19.
Those exceptions for compassionate, you know, compassionate visiting. So if somebody is close to the end of their life, there may be exceptions and family members are allowed to visit when allowed. Does that extend to COVID-19 patients?
We have had visitors visit COVID-19 patients at the end of life. We've been creative with how we've done it. I'll leave it at that. But we have helped people see their loved ones at the end of life.
Can you talk, Dr. Leffler, a little bit about the impact this shutdown of almost all non-critical, non-urgent procedures has had on your medical center's finances? We know there have been significant layoffs. We know that hospitals rely on these elective procedures to make up a lot of the money that can help balance their budgets. What is the impact for UVM Medical Center?
So starting in mid-March, about 50% of our volume went away. About 50% of the care that we typically deliver in a day, a week, a month, stopped happening. And it was for a good reason. It was to keep our patients and staff safe, to preserve our PPE, and to prepare for a surge. But in the month of March, that meant we lost about $30 million. And we project that we could lose as much as $100 million by the end of the year without some significant changes. So we have been adjusting our staffing to meet the demands of how much services we're delivering right now. But that's a tough thing to do. But we're working on it every day right now.
So, I mean, that's a significant chunk. You're working on it every day, but what is your estimation of what this is going to look like moving forward for UVM Medical Center financially?
So we have a plan to help get us at least even by the end of the year, and that really relies on three different areas of focus. Some of it's getting some stimulus support from the federal government. Most of it's about getting care, resuming elective surgeries and both inpatient and outpatient surgeries, getting patients back who've been patiently waiting to get services they need. And then some of it's adjusting our staffing model to fit the amount of care that we're delivering. And based on working through all those three things, we have a plan to get us back to at least break even by October 1st.
Break even by October 1st. That's what you're hoping.
That's our goal.
And can you tell me how many people have laid off and if they are expected to be brought back?
So to this point, we haven't laid off anyone. We're using a combination of furloughs where people are still employed. We're maintaining their benefits, but we've sent them away for as long as 10 weeks. We're using some mandated CTO. To offset that, when this first started, we did give most of our employees a week of extra salary, and we're allowing people to go negative on their CTO if they need it. And our hope is to bring back everyone that's been furloughed back to being employed as we get busier. That's what we want. That's what we want for our staff, and we want to be here to provide care for our patients.
How many people have been furloughed?
We're down about 550 FTEs right now.
550 were furloughed.
It's a mixture of furloughs and and CTO.
Got it. Wow, that's a significant number. What percentage is that?
We have 8,000 total employees, so I'm doing the math in my head right now. Is it like 7%?
Yeah, something like that. Very, very well done. Jody Stack, what about for Brattleboro? Were there significant layoffs as well?
We did not have any layoffs. We did have a small percentage of furloughs, none of which were clinical staff, but some of the administrative support. As we shrunk down our services to the very core essential services, we did furlough some staff, and we have brought them back in a phased approach.
And they're all back now?
They are not all back, but week by week, as we're adding services back in, we're again, a phased approach to reopening and a phased approach to bringing back staff. We had really, in addition to, narrowing down our services, we also narrowed down, certain buildings or entryways. So we're really trying to take the same structured approach to rebuilding as we did when we went into incident command and shut things down. But they are all being phased back in.
And Jody, you said no clinical staff were furloughed.
No.
Wow. So unlike UVM Medical Center, nobody who was actually working with patients in that capacity as a medical staffer, a medical, a nurse or a doctor was furloughed.
No, we there were services where there's clinical staff, nursing or providers that were narrowed down, but we took those staff and took the opportunity to train up in other areas. So, we had OR nurses working in the front of the emergency department. We redeployed people into our community to support our community partners. So everybody had a role in this last 2 months.
And, what are you doing to help out staff members who may be parents and may not have any childcare lined up now or even in the next couple of weeks or months? How are they being accommodated? Jody.
So we have, tried to allow for some time off and some respite time, regardless of what people have, going on at home. We've been full steam ahead, with training and all of those things. So we're trying to provide for some time off. We also have a fund that we have for our employees that have seen significant contributions in the last couple of months, and that's to help with things like childcare or, things like that. So we've been very supportive of our staff. We've been lucky. They support each other. Trying to assist our HR department, tries to assist people with finding childcare if they need it, and different resources that they might need.
Jody Stack is Chief Nursing Officer and Vice President of Patient Care Services at Brattleboro Memorial Hospital. Jody, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Stephen Leffler is President and Chief Operating Officer at the UVM Medical Center. Dr. Leffler, thank you very much to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get a surgical perspective now. Dr. Ben Rosenberg is an orthopedic surgeon at Porter Medical Center in Middlebury, part of the UVM network, and he joins us now. Hi, Dr. Rosenberg.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So, we've been talking about the sort of the pediatric perspective, then we talked about the larger administrative and hospital perspective. Are there challenges in surgeries in particular or in the actual areas where surgeries are done within a medical center that have more challenges than somebody might expect as you ramp back up?
Well, Jane, there are some challenges. It should be understood that having an operation is not just done by a surgeon. It's done by a whole team of medical personnel, each of whom is really critical to the success of the procedure. And like any team, the team that gets to play together a lot becomes more effective and more efficient. And for the last 2 months, our team has been sitting on the bench. So we're just, that's not entirely true. We have been doing some emergency surgeries, but certainly markedly decreased from our usual. So we're now trying to ramp back up and getting our team back playing together. And it's going to take a little bit before all the new workflows that are being required because of the COVID response become smooth. So in order to do that, we've purposefully scheduled surgical cases more spaced apart. We've given allotted more time for each procedure and more time in between procedures to allow for safety of cleaning the rooms, making sure that every T is crossed and I is dotted to ensure the safety of our patients and the success of our procedures.
Do you think surgeries will actually take longer because you're not in that sort of efficient, smooth teamwork mode?
Most of us have done the procedures that we do dozens, hundreds of times. So the actual surgical procedure itself should be pretty smooth. It's really just sort of getting the patient into the hospital, having pre-op check work done, getting them into the operating room, making sure we're respecting social distancing, et cetera, and then the time that it takes to sterilize the room and make sure that the air has been filtered out appropriately between patients to ensure safety. That's what's going to take more time.
How much more significant are those sanitation procedures and that air filtration? I mean, most people would assume that, especially in a surgical suite, most of that would already be occurring.
Well, we've been given information that in order to really be extra safe, the room should sit empty for 15 minutes after one patient leaves and before the other patient comes in. And that's actually before we start bringing in new instruments and new setups. So that's a 15 minutes right there between every procedure that we hadn't previously done.
What does that 15 minutes do?
It's thought to be time to cycle the air through the room several times, actually. And operating rooms do have efficient air handling capacities, and I'm not an expert in that, but I've been told by the folks who have been studying that, that this gives an extra layer of precaution to really ensure clean air and safe environment in a COVID era.
Mm. I interrupted you. You were talking about the other procedures that are being done in between patients.
Well, really just checking people in. One thing that's that your previous guest mentioned, I think Dr. Leffler mentioned, that we're not yet clear to do procedures that require overnight stays, and we're not quite really been encouraged to do procedures that require general anesthesia, because general anesthesia often requires introduction of a breathing tube into the patient. Sometimes that can lead to coughing and expelling air into the room, and that's considered a riskier situation. So we've been not yet cleared to do general anesthesia on routine basis, although in selected cases we have been doing them all along and will continue to do so. But that will take significantly longer. There's a lot more personal protective equipment that the anesthesia staff and the nursing staff has to wear if a patient is going to have general anesthesia. So there are many steps that are being introduced to ensure safety, but all of them carry with it increased time and therefore less overall throughput into our through our operating rooms.
We got a note from Jan, or actually a call from Jan in Putney, who wanted to know if knee replacement procedures are being scheduled and if they're considered inpatient.
That's a really good question. Historically, knee replacement surgeries have been inpatient procedures. Most patients have stayed overnight at least one night. Historically, it used to be a week, and now we've gradually shortened that down to a couple of days or even one night. In selected cases, different centers are doing outpatient knee replacement procedures. That's being done more commonly in, elsewhere in the country, not very common in Vermont yet, although just before the whole COVID epidemic hit, we were just starting to make inroads into the outpatient knee replacement procedure. However, at this point, we haven't yet done that as a routine, so we're not scheduling knee replacement procedures yet, although we hope to be by certainly, well, hopefully earlier in June.
Would that go for hip replacement as well?
That would, although interestingly, hip replacements have been done a little bit more frequently as outpatient procedures as certain techniques have evolved to allow that a quicker recovery for hip replacements. So there have been a few outpatient hip replacement procedures done around the state, and that may come a little sooner than knee replacements.
Dr. Rosenberg, are there procedures that would be typically conducted surgically or medical conditions that would be treated surgically that are currently not being performed by surgeons that are being taken care of in another way? And is that, do you think, a semi-permanent shift, or will certain things go back to surgery?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. There are a lot of, when we're talking about elective surgical procedures, there are a lot of things that can be managed non-surgically or surgically.
Mm-hmm.
And surgeons and physicians in general have been looking at really what is the best answer. Sometimes we think that surgical treatment might be the best answer, but when you look carefully at the results, it may be that non-surgical treatment may be as effective. Sometimes that's hard to accept for patients and surgeons. Somebody comes in with a torn meniscus cartilage, for example. In some cases, the standard treatment in the past had been, well, we'll go in arthroscopically and trim out the torn piece of cartilage. Turns out that's not always necessary. And so The future may suggest that if surgical procedure isn't absolutely necessary, maybe it's best to delay it or postpone it altogether. And that's probably a good thing. At the same time, if a problem is not really going to lend itself to non-surgical fixation, we're going to have to still treat it surgically, but there may be a delay as we try to catch up with our backlog.
Hmm. And are you? Do you feel like you're getting faster now? Are you actually doing procedures, or is all of this getting ready sort of taking the place of doing the procedures and the surgeries right now because it takes so long to ramp up?
Well, this week we're back at it. It's going to take a little longer to get through our backlog, but we're back at work, and we're very happy to be able to serve our patients again.
What do you want patients to know who may have a surgery in their future?
Try to be patient. We have in our office, we have 75 surgical patients and over 100 clinic patients who have to be rescheduled from the past couple of months to say, you know, to add on to the patients that are waiting to come in. So try to be as patient as you can. We're trying to work through it as quickly as we can.
Dr. Ben Rosenberg is a surgeon with Porter Orthopedics, part of Porter Medical Center in Middlebury, part of the UVM network. Dr. Rosenberg, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Jane. Thank you.